So did anybody come up with an answer to Fran's question here? What's her name?
John.
What are the bases that otherwise known as a middle scope being, perhaps? Yes, Four Noble Truths. If you expand on the Four Noble Truths, you get to the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. So a thorough meditation on the Four Noble Truths requires you to know the 16 aspects of the Four Noble Truths. We will come to those. They're very much part of the fourth chapter. So we'll have an opportunity. Certainly we want to look at those later this weekend, or perhaps in the third weekend in November. So definitely they are, you can say everything is a base. Everything that exists is a base. In technical language, existent and established base, they are both, equivalent. So this is an established base. So this is a base. When we say established base, we mean established by a valid cognizer, established by valid cognition. That's the Buddhist definition of how something exists, It's established by a valid cognizer. So we're all phenomena are bases, but the ones that the hearers especially need to know about, their sort of more limited focus, is the Four Noble Truths. Personal selflessness, the selflessness that gets you out of a psychic existence, selflessness of persons, the sort of grosser level of selflessness, is enough for them, according to the autonomist middleway school. Okay, so that's the people of the first couplet of the first two lines there. But then in the second two lines, we're talking about the knower of paths. So knower of the paths, so those are the people who needs to know the knower of the paths. They're the bodhisattvas. So the bodhisattvas are the people who have the knower of paths in their continuum, primarily. Of course, you say the Buddha, he also has the knower of paths in his continuum, of course. So Buddha also has the knower of basis. Buddha knows personal selflessness, of course. But the two lines are especially the second couplet especially are talking about the bodhisattvas. So the mother of the Buddhas and the mother of the Buddhas here at bodhisattva companies, for the bodhisattva, she's appearing, or she's in the form of the knower of paths. So the ones who are working the good of beings, the ones who are achieving the world's welfare, those are the bodhisattvas, right? So it's not specifically said, but that's who they're talking about. So, they're ones who want to help everybody, right? So they need to know all the different paths that all different people need. Some people need to be taught the Mahayana path. Some people need to be taught, the absence of true existence, the subtle selflessness of all phenomena, which you need to get to Buddhahood. Other people just need to be taught something a bit simpler, like the Four Noble Truths and the path to personal nirvana. And maybe there are other people who need other teachings too, so it's not sort of limited to those two. But those are the sort of the variety of things that Bodhisattva needs to know in order to achieve his or her goal, which is, achieving what the world wants. So the world's welfare, what do the world want? Well, they want practical help. They want some sort of, temporary help, maybe. So the bodhisattva is not forgetting that. So there's the temporary welfare, but then there's the ultimate welfare of, complete freedom from suffering, one form or another. So all those things are sort of on the bodhisattva's agenda. So that's the knower of paths. And then the third one, and well endowed with whom, so now we're not talking about the knower of basis, we're not talking about the knower of paths, we're talking about the knower of all aspects, the all-encompassing, complete, omniscient knowledge of a Buddha. So knower of all aspects is simply, you know, another way of referring to Buddhahood, omniscience. Knower of all, omniscience. And funnily, they say knower of all aspects. So why they're saying aspects is not quite sure. But knower of all aspects, knower of everything, knower of all phenomena. So it's the Buddha's special vocation, you know, the sages, that's the Buddhas, right? Sages means Buddhas here. Yeah? So the sages, when they have the knower of all aspects, what are they empowered to do? So the knower of all aspects is their empowering condition or something. Huh? So it's their empowering condition to enable them to have the power to do what? Well, it's to turn the wheel of Dharma, isn't it? So we specifically think of the Buddha as the wheel-turning Buddha here, the Buddha who turns the wheel of Dharma and teaches. So we have the Buddha in the singular there. So it's the world teaching, the wheel-turning Buddha of our era, Buddha Shakyamuni. So it's like the Buddha who's maybe the emanation, the supreme emanation body. You know? Of course, there are many Buddhas all around us, but the supreme emanation Buddha, who the one who comes and turns the wheel of Dharma in the world, or turns the wheel of Dharma in many worlds simultaneously, maybe we can say. So that's the one who is especially being referred to here when we talk about the knower of all aspects. So that aspect of the mother, that variety of the mother, is one that they have, you know, this complete omniscience. So then they can teach everybody in the way they need their omniscience, so that they can have a sort of real insight into any particular person's, you know, the teaching which suits them. So many different teachings of many different types of people. You see you read through the Buddha's scriptures, you see the many teachings given to all sorts of different people who are, you know, coming from all different points of view. So the Buddha's got a teaching for them all, as suits them. So that's why he needs this sort of omniscient kind of the fully perfected wisdom, the actual perfection of wisdom. The wisdom that is perfected is the wisdom on the Buddha ground. So the wisdom that knows all phenomena in one instant. So that's the mother of the Buddhas, as far as the mother as far as the Buddhas go. So this is the subject. This is the subject matter of the Ornament of Clear Realization. It's how to set forth those different aspects of perfection of wisdom, or trainee perfection of wisdom, so that those particular types of being can achieve their particular aims. So if you remember, we've got the three vehicles and four superiors. I'm just moving over to the my handout now. So are you absorbing this idea of the three vehicles and four superiors? Yeah? So we're just going to say a bit about that, just because there are slight complications still. So when he says, I bow down to the mother of the Buddha, the hearer, and bodhisattva companies. So that sounds like three, doesn't it? Three types of being. But yet, when we look at our paper, we've got four superiors. So who's the other one who's been left out? Yes, those sort of shadowy beings. There's a lot less is said about, so it's hard to know where they're at, really. Solitary realizers. If you had to condense the four into three, the four superiors into three superiors, where would you put the solitary realizers? Who do they go with most closely? They go with the heroes most closely, yeah. So it's a variety of, you know, a more sort of advanced variety of hero, but still they end up in personal nirvana. They don't end up in complete Buddhahood, you know, when they've achieve the aims of their vehicle. So their sort of resting place is nirvana, personal nirvana. Yeah, so you have to take those on board. They're not mentioned in the homage, you know, that's more kind of, you know, condensed. But they are mentioned elsewhere. and they do have their own special meditations. You know, they do have their own features, their own path, sort of unique to them. So we do need to kind of think about them occasionally. Yes. Just to be clear about what superior means, is any hearer a hearer superior or superior hearer? Or is any bodhisattva a superior bodhisattva? How many points between those two? You people who know how to do points. Hearer and hearer who is a superior. Superior hearer. Or you can ask between a bodhisattva and a superior bodhisattva. And a Buddha and a Buddha superior. That's a bit more difficult to answer. But yeah, the hearer, how do you get to be a hearer then? Just have to have ears, is that it? Lend me your ears. I will be a hearer. Yeah, well, if you really understood them, then you'd be in Nirvana, right? But you're a hearer a bit before you get to Nirvana, aren't you? Yes, that's more like it, a bit of renunciation. Yeah, and how do you get to be a superior hearer? Realizing selflessness of persons. But more to it than that, directly, whether we know what that means, I don't know, but directly means with your direct mental consciousness, just as we can see yellow or, you know, white color directly with our eye consciousness, we don't have to think about it. Direct realization, no sort of conceptual representation involved. So when you can see emptiness at that level of purity, you know, that level of intensity, then you know you become somebody very special. You become somebody who is an object of refuge. You know, you become part of the refuge tree. You see, so it's not just realizing emptiness selflessness in this case with a conceptual mind. You know, with a reasoning. That's the first stage. So we're going to try and do that a bit now. Realize the ultimate truth. Yeah, but you have to realize it directly, not just with the the conceptual reasoning consciousness that you initially realize. So it's a very intense yogic direct perceiver, they say. Something that you've meditated on the results of your conceptual understanding, your inference, you know, your reasoned inference gets you to the truth, but then you've got to meditate on that very strongly, and then you have this direct realization, which is, that really burns away your afflictions then. It really burns away the seeds of your, delusions and upsetting minds. So I'll just point you, just briefly, I'm not going to look at the whole chart, but just point you at this particular chart, which is also today's handout. Some of you not familiar with these things, you might look at that in terror and say, you know, that's completely incomprehensible. You know, this whole mass of data and, you know, boxes, how can I possibly understand that? Pardon? That's because you came late, Radek. Cycling in at the last minute. So I'm not explaining all these complications, you know, right now. Haven't you got one? Maybe there's one here. So that just shows you a diagram form of the points I've been making now about hearer or hearer superior, you know, these different vehicles. And, you know, some people it's clearer to see it in this sort of a more pictorial form. So here we are in samsara. We managed to get out of the lower realms, so we're in get a precious human rebirth. So at that point, you know, we can develop, you know, real sort of a kind of a get a good grasp of the our predicament here. So we develop renunciation. Don't want any of that. And we hear the teachings that we can get out of samsara, and we sort of have confidence in those teachings. So renunciation, we determine to, you know, to put all our efforts, all our heart into getting out of samsara, renunciation. Then if we are, if that's the best we can do, then we enter the lesser vehicle. Right at that point, we become a hearer. Or maybe we become a solitary realizer, a solitary conqueror. So that's possible. But renunciation is the gateway, is like the criteria. Not just, oh, I think it's a good idea to do that, like, but real intense, you know, ever-arising kind of a spontaneous revulsion for cyclic existence. You really meditated and really enough to be, it's really part of your character that you're just determined to get out of cyclic existence. And on top of that, you see, you don't just think about your own suffering, but you think about the suffering of everybody else too. So you've really got to the suffering of others. My mother, sentient beings, is unbearable. You know, it's just disgraceful that it should go on. And you know, here is the way to really empower myself to do something about it. And so you're really inspired to go as far as necessary, you know, to help all beings out of their suffering. So you realize you don't just want to go to your own personal nirvana, but you must go to Buddhahood, supreme perfect enlightenment. So I will become enlightened for the sake of all sentient beings. In the verses, in the word of the ornament of clear realizations, you know, mind generation is for others' sake, the wish for full enlightenment. So that's the Mahayana mind generation. So for others' sake, I'm going to get the full enlightenment. Others' sake, you know, others' suffering, you know, that's spurring me on to reach the highest goal I can possibly attain. So you're entering the Mahayana vehicle then, the great vehicle. And you can see, if you look on the one side, on the left-hand side, you've got mundane paths versus superior paths. So the superior, the criteria if you're passing from mundane level to superior level is realization of your, you know, the ultimate truth corresponding to your vehicle. So if it's the hearers, you'll be realizing this personal selflessness. But if it's a solitary conqueror, you're realizing the absence of, you know, you're realizing the mind-only realization of absence of a different substance between apprehender and apprehended. You know, you're realizing basically that there's no external phenomena, right? You know, sort of a coarse level of selflessness of phenomena. And then if you are entering the universal, the great vehicle, you really realize you need this. You realize the absence of true existence, the subtle level of the selflessness of phenomena, which is what we're going to talk about now. Yes. Now that's written here. If you look at the back of handout one, which you no doubt were studying for the last month. Back of handout one from last month, the presentation of three vehicles of four superiors. Yeah? So, I mean, maybe just have to course through this quite quickly, though, but, you know, you've got the basis for your own study if we just point this out here. So Steffi's question is about the solitary realizer, but we just whiz through the three brief descriptions. So the hearer vehicle, so the hearers enter their path to nirvana by developing the thought to certainly forsake the world, renunciation. On the wisdom side, they mainly realize and familiarize on the Four Noble Truths. And, you know, when you get to what selflessness, what type of selflessness are you realizing, you realize, of course, the gross selflessness of persons, but also the subtle selflessness of persons, which is the absence of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self. We'll talk about that when we get on to the fourth chapter, okay? But it's kind of not the kind of subtle level of realization of those other vehicles. but it's enough to get you out of samsara, according to this the autonomists. And then they become foe destroyers by abandoning the afflictive obscurations. You know, that's what they've got to get rid of. That's what's hindering them. That's the ignorance and so forth that is the kind of fogging up their minds so that they cannot get out of psychic existence. And thereby they reach their own respective individual liberation from suffering. So that's the hero vehicle. Now the solitary realizer vehicle, which Steph is asking about, the solitary realizer enter their longer path to nirvana by developing the thought, certainly to forsake the world, renunciation. So their initial realization is the same. But on the wisdom side, they realize and familiarize also on the 12 links of dependent relativity. So a little bit more, you know, sophisticated thinking than the Four Noble Truths per se, the 12 links of dependent relativity. And their object of meditation is a core selflessness of phenomena. So they don't just meditate on personal selflessness. They have a way of meditating on the selflessness of all phenomena. What selflessness do they realize? They realize the absence of apprehender and apprehended being different substantial entities. Okay, so that's something we'll have to come along later. But it's like the mind-only realization. There's no external phenomena. There's a different substance to the mind apprehending it. Yeah? Very sort of a, you know, dreamlike kind of a presentation of reality here. So we have an appearance of an external phenomenon to our minds. Blue appears to our minds. Blue appears to the eye consciousness apprehending blue. But behind the appearance, there's no external blue. That's an illusion that keeps us confused. Keeps us away from, realizing our Buddha nature, that we have these misunderstandings of phenomena like that, and so we grasp at them as really existing externally and develop our kind of, troubled minds as a result of that. So that's their mind-only type of core selflessness of phenomena. So that's what they realize. Okay, Steffi? When they realize it directly, then they get onto the superior paths. They become solitary realizer superiors. So yes, 3 points between solitary realizer superior. Yeah. So then when they've complete their meditations, then they become the foe destroyers. That means they're out of psychic existence. They've reached their nirvana. So what do they abandon? What's the ignorance they're abandoning? They're abandoning the coarse knowledge obscurations, and they're reaching their own respective individual liberation from suffering. So they're still in individual nirvana when they get there. The bodhisattva vehicle. So this is they're using their knower of paths, as we say, and they from the homage there, the bodhisattvas are. Okay, so they enter their much longer path, the non-abiding nirvana, by also developing the thought to achieve full enlightenment. Yeah? Not enough to develop renunciation. Not enough just to wish for get out of cyclic existence. Of course they must have those. They must have this desperately strong wish to get out of cyclic existence. They must have this desperately strong wish, to be free. But also, they have, the bodhicitta. Yeah? They also have the thought to achieve full enlightenment. Not just to get out of samsara, but full enlightenment, So they can help all sentient beings. So the renunciation is not just get out of cyclic existence yourself as fast as possible. Yes, but they're rejecting samsara all the same, aren't they? Even though they're prepared to work there for the sake of others, still they're rejecting it forcefully as a place to be. So they have a renunciation in that sense. Okay. But they also develop the wish to achieve full enlightenment for the sake of others, bodhicitta, and as it's often called in the Ornament for Clear Realization literature, mind generation, by which you should know Mahayana mind generation of this specific type as defined. So, along with their vast deeds of helping others, on the wisdom side, they realize and familiarize on the subtle selflessness of phenomena, the absence of true existence. So what they have to realize in order to get to Buddhahood is something that's a little bit, you know, subtler than what the solitary realizers and the hearers have realized. So this is the autonomy level, the autonomy sort of presentation, right? Middle way autonomy school presentation. So you get diversions from the consequentialist school. What you may have heard when you're studying Lamrim and understanding the consequentialist view as the highest view, you'll find some differences. So here, each vehicle has its own specific realization, of sort of different levels of subtlety. Right? Absence of true existence, that's what you've got to go for if you want to be a bodhisattva in this school. Okay, so then, can I just read to the last, to the end there? They become Buddhas also by abandoning the subtle knowledge obscuration. So that's their final subtlest level of ignorance, which the other two types of superiors don't come near. But the bodhisattvas get through it, you know, clear it all away. So they become Buddhas at that point. They abandon all obscurations whatsoever, thereby achieving the ultimate of fruits, the two bodies, the Dharma body in fulfillment of their own purpose and the form body in fulfillment of others' purpose. Yes, John?
I don't see the strong link that exists in the way this is presented between your motivation and the view that you end up with. So the motivation, but the citta motivation, I don't see why you shouldn't still end up with the same realization as you've got here in the solitary realization of the hero.
Mm.
And vice versa.
Mm. The consequentialist view, which some of us may be familiar with, more familiar with, all the vehicles just realize the same emptiness. It's not a question of having a different realization. It's just the intensity with which you meditate on it. But in this school, yeah, they say that just to get out of cyclic existence, that's all you need to do. All you need to do is realize this kind of personal selflessness, the absence of a self-sufficient, substantially existent self, a person. Yeah. So then you will get out of cyclic existence. That's enough. And then to achieve your goal as a solitary realizer, then you meditate on this meditation, which is this, you know, the mind-only type of meditation. But if you want to go all the way to Buddhahood, you have to have a sort of stronger, sort of subtler understanding of reality. So you have to have a more powerful vision, you know, of emptiness at the most subtle level, the emptiness of all phenomena. And only through doing that will you burn away the subtle levels of obscuration, the subtle ignorance, which, you know, you've still got if you're just a hearer. You know, you're in your solitary nirvana. You realize enough to get out of cyclic existence, but you haven't got the insight that you need as a Buddha to be able to you know, teach all beings in whatever way they need. You haven't got the understanding of that direct realization of other people's minds, which you need, and you haven't got that vast wave of merit, of course, you need as well to get that far. So, yeah, because your goal is sort of, you know, different, then you need a sort of different level of understanding of ultimate truth to get there. For the time being, yeah, they're just at rest. Joyfully they go on, yeah. It's a tremendous achievement, yeah. But you look at the way the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras are talking; they're really saying, yeah, the merit you get from being a Buddha, a Bodhisattva, is so much greater, and the fruits of, you know, persisting with the Buddha, the Bodhisattva path, is so much greater. So, if you know you're not of that sort of lesser lineage, then just do go for, you know, try your best to get to Buddhahood. Yeah. But if that's just perform the, you know, practice the Dharma you're capable of, it's not putting these people down. Everybody's got to do what they're capable of, right? Yeah. Yeah. Consequentialist. Yeah. It's going to take a while for it to become clear. So it is all complicated, yeah. So. I think I understand your question, but first of all, remember, you don't just realize, if you just realize the absence of true existence, or realize the absence of inherent existence, that's not equivalent to Buddhahood. Yeah, that's just the beginning. Yeah? You've got to meditate on it very intensively. First of all, you realize it with reasoning. So then you have a conceptual understanding, which for those, that's a fantastic achievement in itself. But then you keep meditating on that strongly, then you get direct realization, this yogic direct perceiver, that direct mental awareness of, so that's when you become a superior being. So then there's another, you know, great collection of merit is needed then, meditating in emptiness, collecting merit, alternating, working the aims, you know, working for the world, benefiting the world, meditating in emptiness, and then eventually you reach Buddhahood after three countless great aeons of, you know, effort, you build up this great wave of wisdom and merit. So, both the autonomy school and the consequentialist branch of the middle way school, so I'm trying to use the English words, I kind of feel that's easier, but some people are used to the Sanskrit, obviously. Yeah, so you've got the middle way school following Nagarjuna's interpretation of, you know, his explanation of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So you've got the autonomy school saying, you know, this is what the subtle selflessness of emptiness is all about. Subtle selflessness is a phenomena. And you've got the consequences saying, yeah, but you've still got a subtle clinging to self, mate. You haven't quite, you know, we can refine that a little bit. So the consequences come along and have their even more radical kind of presentation of emptiness. So the consequentialist school, which is in the end our own view, we say this Fatantikas, the autonomous, okay, you're also following Nagarjuna, you're still middle wayers, but your view has still got some subtle clinging to self. So it doesn't quite, you know, it's not quite the sort of the meditation you need. But there's a very subtle difference. Well, that's how they understand it. That's how they've figured it out. That's the view of the masters of their school. If you read people like Bhavivaka or Sankarakshita, that's the way they present it. The three vehicles are very much divided by the object that you're supposed to meditate on. Never mind how intensely you meditate on it. Never mind what your motivation is, mere relief from samsara, or, you know, Mahayana grand, super powerful bodhicitta motivated meditation, never mind the power of your motivation, the actual object you meditate on is different. And it's only the bodhisattvas who've got to get rid of the real subtle obscuration. It's only them who need to meditate on the most subtle form of selflessness. So this kind of makes sense in a way, doesn't it? You know, if all you need to do is get rid of your afflictions of anger and attachment, and, you know, you sort of, how do you do that? Meditate on the emptiness of self, you know, the selflessness of persons, sort of emptiness of the self-sufficient, substantially existent self, and you get rid of them, and then off you go. But if you really want to kind of have the complete omniscience of a Buddha, you know, complete kind of no obscurations in mind whatsoever, so you can really just, you know, effortlessly emanate teachers and help to whatever beings are karmically ready for it, then you need a much clearer state of mind, so you need a much subtler object of sort of emptiness meditation to make your mind that pure, you see. Well, if you fulfill the goal of each of those different vehicles, you're kind of in a place where you won't come back to samsara. So each, they're all similar in that sense. I mean, you can come back voluntarily, but you're not sort of, you know, thrown here willy-nilly. Yeah, so it's all going to be you know, just settling slowly. Don't worry, it's a lot of material to take on board, and you know, it's early days. But it's all contained in the homage, you see. It's all kind of condensed there in a very, like, put there in a very sort of, you know, concise, eloquent way. And gradually the meaning kind of unfolds, you see. It's not like they're putting it in a very simple, easy to explain form, you know, step by step, making it kind of, you know, easy to digest. They're putting it in a very concentrated, poetic, beautiful way, so that it's there, like, and you just recite it, and you think about it, and gradually the meaning kind of, you know, comes to you, and you see all the ramifications and all the aspects of what it is you need to know. Right? So there's all sorts of things you need to know. There are two obscurations, right? Three vehicles, right? Four superiors, five paths, six perfections. Seven for the 70 topics, yeah? Seven for the 70 topics. Eight for the eight clear realizations. Nine for the nine levels of samsara. 10 for the 10 bodhisattva grounds, yeah? You've got to know all these things. You know that song? Green Grow the Rushes, oh. The song, your campfire song? Green Grow the Rushes, oh. Weren't you ever in the Girl Guide, Steffi? Oh, that's enough. English, good English folk song, what is it? What is your one, oh green grow the rushes, oh? One is one and all alone and evermore shall be, so. I mean, lots of us know that song. You were in the Girl Guides, huh? Yeah, see, we know this. So it goes, then it goes right up to 12. What is your 12, oh, right? So it's, what is it, 12 for the 12 apostles, 11 for the 11 went up to heaven, and 10 for the 10, 10 for the 10 commandments, 9 for the 9 bright shiners, 8 for the 8 will reign, 7 for the 7 stars in the sky, and 6 for the 6 proud walkers, 5 for the symbols at your door, and 4 for the gospel makers, 3 the rivals, 2 the lily white boys, clothed all in green, oh well, 1 is 1 and all alone, and evermore shall be. You've heard of that thing. So we got the Buddhist version of it now.
12 days of Christmas.
Yes, that's a similar sort of thing, you see. So Buddhists have got our own now. Where are the superiors in the verse? Yes. Well, somebody who's a knower of bases, somebody who's got the hearer, somebody who's got the direct realization, is Well, we're talking about the first verse, yeah.
Oh, I see.
So if you've got the narrow basis, you will be a superior, won't you? You'll have realized you're at least one of the versions of the mother directly. So that means you are a superior being. I think that's right, yeah. And I've got the definition somewhere, but we haven't given them out. Have you got them there? Those things you photocopied for me? Just give me, you've got the original, see. Don't give them out to everybody, but we'll just... So eventually you get to definitions of these things. We don't have time today, but... for instance, Nara of Bases. So it's an exalted wisdom, yeah? And it has to be conjoined with the wisdom directly realizing selflessness. So if you have a Nara of Bases, you have directly realized selflessness as persons. Minimum, yeah. So if narrow paths, you've directly realized subtle emptiness, yeah. So all of those knowers that are praised in the first verse are all direct realizations. As I say, to be a bodhisattva, you don't have to have realized emptiness directly. So there's such a thing as a bodhisattva who isn't a superior. And to be a hearer, you don't have to have realized your personal selflessness directly. No, that's something different. That's more about just wishing to go and going, you know. No, that's bodhisattvas on more on the conventional level. That's not quite the same thing. So, 3 points between a bodhisattva and superior bodhisattva. 3 points between hearer and hearer superior. How many points between Buddha and Buddha superior? Maybe you don't. Maybe some of you haven't heard of this description of things, with comparing them with points. I don't know. But that's a bit more on the sort of Buddhist debating side. Some of my students and students of Josh, Tenzin Josh, have studied a bit about that. But we haven't really got time to go into it. But when we have time, we will. Well, I'm asking you. Yeah, so think about that one. But it just means that the bodhisattva is the larger category and the bodhisattva superior is the smaller category within the larger category. So you can be a bodhisattva without being a bodhisattva superior, but if you're a bodhisattva superior, you will be a bodhisattva. So it's like the superior category is a smaller one inside the larger one. See? Yeah, it's how you compare things and... Yeah, maybe then when you get a commentary on what the word mahasattva, bodhisattva, mahasattva, Avalokiteshvara, whatever, Chenrezig, then you say that mahasattva indicates superior bodhisattva. I should imagine so. Yeah, so we've got so little time, really. I mean, before lunch, I was hoping to do a little bit of meditation on this true existence. But we're having breaking for lunch at 1 o'clock, are we? Yeah. Are we going to the restaurant or? So we need a bit of time for lunch. We can't really. Make the lunch hour too short. So when you've done the churjo, when they've done this homage, churjo in Tibetan, and there's plenty more to say about it, really, but. What they do at that point is then say, now, what's the purpose of the homage? It is to inspire you to study the text, you see. So what's going to inspire you? Well, this is presentation of this mother, this perfection of wisdom. Right? So that's the thing you can say, well, is that really something that, that we can really aim for, really go for? So inspired by that, inspired by this idea that there is some way out of samsara and, not only your own personal way out, but maybe there's a way to become so vast-minded that you can take on board everybody else's, you know, sufferings and challenges too, you know, and dedicate yourself to working on that level. So that's the power of the mother, that through that realization you can do that, you can achieve those aims. So somebody who's kind of easily persuaded, or somebody who's sort of not of the kind of sharp faculties that wants to prove all these things to themselves, but they have great faith in the Buddha, you know, they can then generate their renunciation, generate their bodhicitta, and enter their path, you see. But then this text, supposedly, the Ornament of a Clear Realization, is written for bodhisattvas of sharp faculties, you see. So those are the actual, you know, particular specific students of the text. You see, so the hearers don't have to study this text because they've got their teaching on the four truths, so that's their kind of, you know, path and their sutras. But the bodhisattvas, they have to study the Perfection of Wisdom sutras, you see. So that's how they're going to get the kind of, you know, the training they need in order to follow their path. So they've got to study the Perfection of Wisdom sutras. So they need the Ornament of Clear Realizations to sort of set things up for them, to explain, you know, what's going on. At least the explicit teaching, but also, you know, we no need to sort of neglect the view side of things, so we're interested in that too. And so the bodhisattva sharp faculties, you see, they develop their faith in the mother by establishing things through reasoning, you see. So at this point in the commentaries in the Tibetan tradition, anyway, you know, following on from the commentaries in the Indian tradition, at this point they introduce true existence and how to meditate in the absence of true existence. So this is kind of a set up as a topic in the traditional study. This is your first introduction to meditating on emptiness properly. Of course, you've studied the Lam Rim and so on, so it's not the first time you've ever meditated on emptiness, but you know. That's the place of it. That's the next topic in this unfolding of this study. So if you'd like to look at the second handout, handout two, which is the first page, the reasoning of one or many according to the Middle Way Autonomy School. Okay, so everybody's got that. By now? Yeah? So just to set up what we're trying to do. So we're following the Middle Way Autonomy School, right? So their version of selflessness, their version of emptiness. And one of their prominent sort of great masters was Shantarakshita, of the 8th century Common Era. Maybe say something about him tomorrow. We don't have to say something so much about him now, but he came to Tibet. He was sort of important figure in the early history of Buddhism in Tibet. And he wrote this text called The Adornment of the Middle Way. So he starts off by talking about emptiness, you see. The entities that our own and other schools affirm, since they exist inherently in neither singular nor plural, in ultimate reality, they are without intrinsic being. They are like reflections. So again, you and I have sort of very precise language, but for us who are just, you know, coming at this subject for the first time, it'll be kind of quite difficult to understand. But the reasoning of one or many, I'm sure some of you have come across that reasoning. So just to read what it says underneath there. The purpose for introducing the reasoning here at this stage of studying the homage verse of the Ornament for Clear Realizations is to generate clear faith towards the mother in the mind of the students so that they engage in the text. So these guys who like to develop their faith, you know, through understanding, through correct reasoning, they don't just want to take it on trust and be followers of faith, they want to be followers of the Dharma, they want to be people who've you know, worked it out and sort of established it by a valid cognizer. So they have to be presented with some reasoning which kind of, you know, allows them, enables them to generate faith that this mother exists. And then the ultimate purpose. Why are we doing this? Why does the author want you to engage in this text? Why does the author want you to engage in study of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras? The ultimate purpose, to clear away the deepest level obstruction to perfect full enlightenment. So don't be content with just a simpler level of selflessness, which won't get you so far. Go for clearing away the deepest level to get to perfect full enlightenment. And so, the object with the refutation is true existence. And the object to be realized, so the object you've got to meditate on, is absence of true existence. So the means of realization is the reasoning of neither one nor many. So that sets up our challenge for us. But there's plenty of other meanings, plenty of other meditations, plenty of other reasonings. So you think we're ready for it? Taking a lot of stuff on board to think about, so maybe it's not the... need some more glucose in the brain or something? Or what? So do you feel you've had a lot thrown at you this morning, a lot of information? Or you kind of got a handle on it from you've studied some of these things before a little bit? No good. It's no good as going too fast, you know, no good going faster than what the class can handle. But of course we'll have a variety of levels, people, their understanding.
Are we going to talk some more about this phrase, since then it's kind of
We can certainly do that. Would you? Yeah, the Sankaracharya, he's a really prime kind of thinker on the Yogacara Middle Way Autonomy School. So this is his effort to get this view across. So his text, The Ornament of the Middle Way, starts with this first. So he's, you know, jumping in sort of feet first, right? Giving you the reason straight away in the first verse. You see, so the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, they talk about, you know, there is no form, no feeling, no discrimination, no compositional factors, and no consciousness, right? So familiar with like this utter denial of, you know, the kind of reality you think that things have, or we think that things have, you know, it's just not there. You know, they're really trying to sort of kind of... present us with a view of reality so radically different from the one we've already got that the best way to do it is by just being completely putting negative to everything that we think at the moment, right? So that's kind of the technique of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutra is suitable for the students at that time who kind of presumably very ripe, you know, very advanced, and sitting on the Masvalchis peak with the Buddha. Kind of all this made great sense. But for people like us, who are a little bit more, or me anyway, who's a bit more limited in our understanding, we need a bit of understanding, a bit of an explanation before we can get to, you know, sort of appreciate the message, right? So then we need to sort of put in some qualification, like, well, they don't. What we mean when we say they don't exist, I mean, it means they don't inherently exist. So that's that kind of a qualification starts to come in, you see, in the commentaries. Another one, you see, the one that is usually associated with the autonomy school is they don't truly exist. But in fact, Shantarakshita in his verse is using don't inherently exist. So then, you know, you might find that in sort of occasionally coming up in Nagarjuna's commentaries. But then what we need then is a reasoning, you know, so why don't they inherently exist, you know? So we need something to jolly us along a bit, you see. We need a bit more a kind of explanation still. So then we need to have a reasoning why they don't exist in this sort of false way. So then we need the reasoning of neither one nor many. So neither singular nor plural, so neither one nor many, neither a kind of a unity or diversity. So that's his presentation of the reasoning. Or antonyms? Yes, it's better that you do, because if I just go on talking, your faces will get very blank. Yes, that's good to bring in, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I'm trying to keep things separate, the view of the autonomy school and the view of the consequences school, a little bit separate, using inherently, you know, that's more associated with our consequentialist view that we've been studying previously. But as we go into this literature, you know, the autonomy view comes up for inspection, so that's true existence then. Absence of true existence is what we're aiming at. Yeah. So I'm keeping them a little bit apart like that. But the difference between them is very subtle. You know, I'm not saying I've understood it at all. You know, it's just like fine shades of meaning. So the autonomy school is coming along and saying, yeah, well, we don't think things inherently exist. So they that's what they think. But, you know, according to Tsongkhapa, their idea of what inherently exists means is a bit sort of rough, you know, a bit sort of incomplete. Yeah, so that, you know, if you look at the text, you'll find that these autonomy scholars using the word inherently, we are rejecting inherent existence. But, you know, it isn't according, they're not rejecting inherent existence according to the way Tsongkhapa understands it. But let's come down to, you know, examples that we can understand, you know. If you say, I mean, I was looking at this in a library in Sheffield, you know, trying to think about how I'm going to sort of talk about this. So, you know, this reasoning of one and many, you know, some of you have probably thought about it a lot, but those of us who haven't, you know, where do we start? So I took this book out of the library. It was this book of paintings, and it was like these abstract paintings by this Russian painter I'd never heard of. His name begins with M. I can't remember his name, Medeyev or somebody, something. Anyway, it's like a painter in the early days of the Russian Revolution. And these paintings, very sort of cubist paintings, are they called? I think it was inspired by people like Picasso, people like Braque, you know, that you sort of disassemble objects and show the same object from many different perspectives at once. So you end up with the beginnings of abstract painting, say, the beginnings of abstraction. So you've got a painting there, and on the painting, you know, these are conventional paintings that are in a sort of rectangular border like that. But then you've got the various blotches of colour, some of which appear to show something, like some dimension of the object. I think the painting was called Musical Instruments, so you could see like the curly top of a violin, or the few strings, you know, and then you'd see the shape of the sound box of the violin sort of here, there. So you get, in between, you get all these different patches of colour, shadings, vanishing perspective, or whatever. You didn't know, because it's this sort of new type of cubist painting, are they called, or is there another word for it? Cubist, or... Yeah, sort of beginnings of abstraction, you see. So when you look at that, are you looking at... What are you looking at? Are you looking at something which is one or something which is many? So that's the question that we can all at least cope with on our, you know, our much lesser sort of level of, you know, we can't figure out the perfection of wisdom, but that question we can ask ourselves. So the abstract painting was kind of quite a good subject, you know. For that, when you're looking at this abstract painting, which is, you know, it's this rectangular thing, and then but it's got all these blotches of colour. Are you looking at something which is one or which is many? Or a classic one for the Buddhists when they're discussing certain points is the mottle on a butterfly's wing. Well, that comes in my when you come down to the reasoning on this paper. That's suggested as a subject, the mottle on a butterfly's wing. So we've all seen the wing of a butterfly with its, you know, variety of colour, all those patches. But there's nothing wrong with my favourite subject, just the bicycle, you know. And this is a reasoning which is going to apply to all phenomena, whether they are permanent phenomena or impermanent phenomena, whatever they are, it says, as Shantaraxis says, the entities that our own and other schools affirm. So this is very, very broad. Anything you want to talk about, whether you want to talk about a person, horses, you know, bags of coal, or, you know, the rain, or whatever you want to talk about, abstract, permanent, individual, you know, general, particular, universal, they're all empty of true existence. So we can take something which is very conveniently, you know, concretely obvious, like, you know, the colours on a painting, a mottle on a butterfly's wing, your body. So when you're looking at a bicycle then, are you looking at one or many? Is it one or is it many? Okay, it's not one. Anybody else? Any other offers? One answer there. It's neither one nor many. Yeah. Anybody else who'd like to say? Without putting any qualification, is it one or many, this bicycle? Depends how you look at it. Ah, it's a philosopher's answer, yeah? Mm-hmm. You've done a bit of studying of dependent arising. Any other answers? One. One, not one. Is it one or many? That's the question. You can waffle on about, you know, you can digress onto, but the actual question is one or many.
The question is the bicycle one or many?
Yeah.
Does it exist inherently as one or many? Is the question.
Well, you know, I'm thinking, oh, these guys, they're a bit dazed. You know, they're looking at me like, oh. We've had a lot of these new concepts that have come in. So I'm thinking, well, let's start off on the easy, simple level of the way, you know, we talk about these things in ordinary, you know, in ordinary conversations. You can bring in the inherently bit in a minute.
You'd have to define what bicycle is, because it's not many.
Well, I'm deliberately choosing something I don't have to define, you know. This pen, is it one of many, eh? Of course, if you thought of Shiva, or, you know, is the highest form of, you know, Shantakya is debating with these non-Buddhist philosophers, you know. So he's tackling some quite difficult concepts, yeah. You know? But are we taking some really simple, like, you know, never mind about who created the world and whether he's one or many, but the bicycle. So we don't need to define bicycle at this stage. Is that flower? Is that one or many? That red flower there?
As a functioning object, it is one.
So you've changed your mind then? You said it was not one. Conventionally, it is. This flower is one. Bicycle is one. Anybody still disagreeing with that? You said it's neither one nor many, didn't you?
So how are we defining one?
Yes, you have to think about all sides of this question. Well, that's one. That's two, you know. Anything more than one is many. Or are there any alternatives, you know, for something that exists? Don't talk about rabbit horns and, you know, kind of, you know, flowers that grow out of the sky. We're not talking about things that don't exist. Is there any alternative for one or many, for things that do exist? Both? Did you say both? Good observation, yeah. So this is what it's going to come down to, parts. So this is going to be the place where, you know, you're going to have to make a space in that for your reasoning, yeah. The flower has many parts. But the flower itself? Yeah. Absolutely. So we go out and we pick a flower. So a immediately indicates something, doesn't it? Pardon? It's ultimately. Ah. So the appearance of one is just, that's an illusion then. And in actual reality, it's many. Really? Yeah, well, that's it. On a conventional level, it's one. People were saying, somebody even used the word conventional level. It's one. But actually, the truer statement is it's many, according to somebody. Rabbit. Yeah. But as what's your name, sorry? Anne has pointed out, we do say a flower. Or we said the flower is beautiful. So we're using, you know, our language is indicating something to us, isn't it? Yes, yeah, because we do kind of signify single and plural a lot in English, don't we? Much more so than Tibetan. So it's quite clear from the, you know, the article we use sometimes, or the verb that we use, whether we that thing is appearing to our minds as one or many. Yeah, so we would say that the flower is one, wouldn't we? So this is a flower. So we're using a singular verb and a, which is only usually used for singular nouns, isn't it? If you have many, you have to say, you know, you can't say a. You can't kind of a parts. You can't, once you, it's completely wrong, isn't it? So a has to be with a singular subject. So we pick a flower. Mm. So we'll probably the best answer for the time being, at least, is that the flower is one. I mean, if you want to disagree, the flower is one. But the flower is one, so it's not many then. Yeah. Yes, this is the thing we've got to come to. We've got to deal with the parts, right? But yeah, when we talk about it, we say a flower, you know, ordinary people in an ordinary conversation, and, you know, who is going to know about flowers? It's going to be people, ordinary people, you know? You know, it's not like flower is something that only the scientists know about. Well, ordinary people understand flowers well enough to talk about them. And you'll notice that they use, when they're talking about something like that, they'll say, a flower, you know. Or a bicycle, I asked, bicycle, is it one? You know, if it's just one bicycle, yeah. A bicycle. I have a bicycle. This is a pen. So that much is kind of, you know, how ordinary people would use it. And you can see when they use words like that, when you think about it, they are just speaking as it appears to their mind. So they're speaking on the basis of the appearance of the object to the mind, right? So they're using labels to communicate on the basis of what they are thinking, see, how it appears to the mind. So it means that flowers, when they say this is a flower, unless the person wants to lie or deceive, the flower is appearing as a single object to the mind, one. But then what about the parts? So it has got loads of parts, right? So that's also, you know, people qualifying their answers by talking about the parts, aren't they? Oh, the flower's got many parts. Pen has got many parts. Bicycle's got many parts. So then, the next question is then, is the flower one right from its own way of being? Is the flower one right from its very own mode of existence? So if you bring up a, you know, inherent existence, this is what, you know, we know that these words like inherent existence, you know, are bandied about, you know, they're used in this context by the philosophers of the trying to understand, you know, the middle way view. So is the flower one right from its own, you know, right from its own way of being, right from within itself? So that's a harder question to answer. Yeah? Is the flower one? Is it just one flower? Yes, okay. I think you should answer yes to that. We've all more or less maybe come down to that. But where does the flower get its oneness from? Yeah? Does the flower get its oneness from, right from within itself? That it is just one just by its own power? Or does it get to be one through some other means? So what, yes, that sounds like a very learned comment. The flower gets its oneness from the side of the apprehender. You know. Sounds quite authoritative, or, you know, quite sort of, you know, quite clever or something, but... but... Go on, let me hear what you've got to say.
A spade is a spade, if I call it.
Well, is that different from what Steffi's saying, or you're agreeing with her? You said he put it in another way. You're agreeing with that, yeah. Hmm. Yes, so we're discriminating flower from everything else that's in the background, or everything else that's in the you know, in the vicinity. So we have to ask then, if somebody says, "Oh yes, flower, the oneness of the flower derives from the simply from the apprehender." So what grounds have you for saying that? I mean, what's your reason? The flower then, it gets its oneness from the side of the apprehender, because?
Because what appears to the eye consciousness of my, what appears to my consciousness is what it's in
there. Mm, but aren't you just seeing what's there? So what's the problem? It's there, so you see it, like, there's the picture of the man standing on the beach. You take a photograph. So the photograph just shows you what's there. So the photograph isn't... Mm. So... yes, oneness is a kind of a quality of the flower. I mean, it's a bit of an abstract quality, but nevertheless, it is a quality. You ask the child, you know, they can tell you how many flowers are there, you know.
But the flower can't tell you very much, can it? If you
no,
ask the flower,
but
do you have a concept of being a singular flower? The flower is unlikely to reply yes.
Mm, that's true. But I'm just saying that the flower is, you know, just like the flower is, has a quality of, you know, red colour. It has a red colour. You know, or the flower is, you know, has a quality of being a daisy or whatever it is. So in some sense, the flower is one. It's kind of an attribute of one, attribute of the flower. But why are you saying that that comes from the side of the apprehender? So this is maybe a question we have to discuss in our post-lunch, you know, discussion session. It's definitely the reasoning which is going to say flower doesn't inherently exist, or flower isn't a sort of a truly existent one. That reasoning is going to come down to the fact that it has parts. So maybe it's better to leave it as it is now and let you just discuss it in groups. Like you had groups last week. And so, last month. So, if you can go in those groups again, read through what's on the paper. It might help you. Yeah. So, when we come back at after lunch break, then the people who weren't here will fit you into the groups. But it seems like we're going for lunch now to a restaurant. So, that may mean a bit of a longer lunch hour. You know, because last time we just tried to have 1.25 hours and it was a bit too short. So maybe we'll have to have till 2:30, really. Okay. So to go over there to the Evelyn Castle, come back, it'll take that long. That's Mike's plan, anyway. Okay, so that'll be our discussion question, you know. Where is the oneness of the flower coming from, yeah? Is it coming from the side of the observer, as Steffi wants to say, or is it coming from the side of the object? Yeah. So this is a perennial question of the people who are trying to get through to the in a middle way view. This is the question they're always asking themselves. Like, the thing seems to exist from its own side, but you know, the scholars are saying it's posited by the mind. So we're in that territory. So anything you can bring from your previous sort of explorations of that. This is what we need to bring up again here. Yeah. So here it's in the context of oneness and manyness. The thing's got many parts, so can it really be one, really all by itself from its own side, when it's got all those parts just kind of hanging about there? Okay, well, we'll leave it there.
How does the question called
How do they, what do they call it? Shinga, shinga. Well, the tree is shing, but they won't say forest, they say shinga. Okay, we're ready. What's the drill? Have we got the prayer?